I understand my responsibility is to speak of some theological perspectives on the Christian and the church in public life, in particular, Christian and the church in politics. Let me say preliminarily that this whole discussion, I think, presupposes two facts. One is the breakdown of any consensus on the public square. The community in which I grew up had a very solid consensus about the values that undergird American life. I think one question we face today is whether or not democracy can survive in a society in which there are no underlying consensus as to the values and the faith commitments that underlie private life as well as public life. And secondly, that any answer we give to this question is historically conditioned. The way the question would have to be answered in East Germany or in Cuba or in Russia today is radically different from the way it is answered in the United States. Now, I think it's important to make clear distinction between two questions. And the first question is the relationship of faith to politics, the faith of the individual, and the faith of the worshiping, believing community. The second question is the relationship of the church as an organized bureaucratic institution to politics. And unless we keep these two factors or aspects or dimensions of the question separate, we shall end up in confusion. Let me begin by saying that faith is always politically active. Faith always shapes personal life, and it always shapes community life. Now, this assertion is not unchallenged. The Marxists insisted, and do insist, that religion and ethics are epiphenomenal to economic factors, that they're determined by economic factors, by how we earn our living, and by how much money we have in the bank. There's certain truth in that. There was a time when we said that you could document that on the campus of Union Seminary. Yet there is a contrary bit of evidence. At the beginning of this century, Trelch and Max Weber, German historians and sociologists, insisted that religion determines economic and political and social life. Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism has been challenged over and over again, yet it survives, for no one has been able to destroy the basic thesis of that work, namely that Protestantism, and in particular Calvinism, was an indispensable ingredient in the development of a capitalistic society in Northern Europe and in the United States. And more recently, another sociologist, Linsky, who now teaches University of Virginia, North Carolina, I believe, argued on the basis of a study of Detroit some 25 years ago that religion still is a factor in determining our attitude toward work. Now, the exact relationship between faith and culture can be debated and never neatly settled. And yet it is a fact that Protestantism and Puritanism have been intimately related to the development of liberal political institutions and to high economic productivity in Northern Europe and in the United States. Sidney Ahlstrom has pointed out that the Reform community was the most influential religious community in colonial America, and that the Westminster Confession was the most influential book in colonial society. Adam Smith, writing in 1776, suggested that the economic future would appear to belong to that section of the world that we now call Latin America. Here were the great cities, the generals and the nobles, the great natural resources. But Adam Smith, writing in 1776, declared that the economic future belonged to the English colonies on the North American coast because of a different faith and a different culture. Now, each one of us here this morning is a very different person from what we would have been because our society is a very different society from what it would have been because of the Protestant Reformation, the Puritan movement, and the Evangelical Awakening. Societies are always shaped by faith. Now, society is also shaped not simply by the faith of the individual, but by the faith of the worshiping, believing community. The witness of the church as a community of faith mightily influences society. This was true in the Roman Empire. It is true today. The church as a community of faith shapes society, not simply by its influence on those who participate within it, but by its witness in the larger community. Herbert Butterfield, certainly one of the 10 or so really great modern historians of this century, has observed that the church has most influenced society, not when it deliberately set out to shape society, but when it was most concerned about the salvation of souls. Namely, the church's greatest influence on society is a byproduct of its basic life as a worshiping, a believing community. Here I'd like to read two paragraphs from Butterfield. Three things, however, seem to illustrate the importance of Christianity in that mundane history which is under discussion. The importance of the particular religion which presided over the rise of what we call Western civilization. They all spring from the very nature of the Christian gospel itself, and their effects on our civilization are merely the incidental results of the ordinary religious activity of the church. They are not a sample or a vindication of the mundane policies of ecclesiastics. They are byproducts of the missionary and spiritual work of the church, and it is not clear that the same mundane benefits would accrue if men set out with the object of procuring the mundane benefits, if men worked with their eyes on the byproducts themselves. They show that the church has best served civilization, not on the occasions when it had civilization as its conscious object, but when it was most intent on the salvation of souls and most content to leave the rest to providence. The three things are the leavening effect of Christian charity, the assertion of the autonomy of spiritual principle, the insistence on the spiritual character of personality. Apart from the softening effect that religion often, but perhaps not always, has on manners and morals, these things have had their influence on the very texture of our Western civilization. Butterfield also comments, and I won't read that whole comment, though it's worth reading, that we ought not to underestimate the influence of preaching in the shaping of society as well as individual life. Preaching is depreciated in our time, but preaching shapes community. It is a great opportunity in the shaping of American life today. More people gather to hear sermons preached than go to football games or to political conventions or do anything else except perhaps look at television. I used to enjoy seeing when I was minister at Auburn, Alabama, and when 75,000 to 80,000 people gathered in Birmingham to see Auburn, Alabama play, that on the next morning, many more people than that gathered within 25 miles of Legion Field to hear the Word of God preached. We ought not to depreciate the sermon and the byproduct of the interior life of the church in shaping community. Therefore, if we want to talk seriously about religion and politics, we have to begin with the life of faith, the faith of the individual, and the faith of the worshiping, believing community. As Visitor once put it, the church's first mission in the world is simply to be what it says it is, the church of the living God. And the second question, which is the relation of the church as an organized bureaucratic body to society. The church has frequently in history attempted to shape society directly and politically. But Protestants have always had difficulty with this. As Protestants, we believe that the church is the people, not the bureaucratic organization, not the curia. As Luther said, the church is not the curia. The church is the people. Protestants defining the church as the people have always had difficulty with direct political action and with persons or institutions or even church courts speaking in the name of the church. No one can really speak for Protestants. The Pope can speak for Roman Catholics, and when he appears at the United Nations, they pay attention. But when W.P. Thompson appeared and said that he spoke for 400 million non-Roman Catholics, everybody yawned because they knew he really didn't. No one can really speak for Protestants, and for that, I am glad. Church courts having neither a Marine Corps nor an IS have power and influence only insofar as they articulate the life of faith which they represent. When Protestants put the Bible in the common language and put it in the hands of private individuals and declared that the final authority is the Holy Spirit speaking through Scripture, they made the ordinary believer an authority over against any king and any bishop. In recent years, many Presbyterians have been shaken by the influence of such church leaders as Farwell. I know for a fact that 10 years ago, political leaders in Virginia did not even know who Farwell was. But today, or at least in the previous administration, when he came to Richmond, he was invited to eat dinner with the governor. Now, some have protested that this is a mixing of religion and politics, but as has been indicated by Professor Smiley, this has a phony sound to it, because Farwell is doing what the National Council and all the mainline churches have attempted to do. The only thing is, the politicians listen to Farwell, and they do not listen to the National Council of Churches, at least not very much. And it's not because of morality, it's simply because of the pragmatic fact that Farwell can deliver votes, and the National Council cannot. Neither can Presbyterian courts or Presbyterian bureaucrats. Church courts are real only if they are genuinely the courts of the people. The question must be raised, if this is any longer the case in Presbyterianism, with our principles of representations and our quota system and so forth, whether the church and our advisors and our emphasis upon process, where the church courts still are the courts of the people. And unless they're the courts of the people, they really have no power. It's worth pointing out that in the past election, probably 95 to 99% of the people in the bureaucratic and organized leadership of the church voted for Mondale. If they, according to New York Times analysis, it is likely that at least 80% of the Presbyterians in the pews voted for Reagan. Now, the question is, can you really have effective leadership in the church with that kind of disparity? And when the church's pronouncements on all subjects, inevitably, as Andrew Greeley, a Roman Catholic critic of Protestantism, says, they can always be predicted to come out on the side of the McGovern wing of the Democratic Party left. Now, this is a real issue that we have to face. I would like to now move quickly to a certain theological emphases that it seems to me we have to take seriously in thinking about this particular problem. Find my watch here. First, let me mention certain convictions that initiate personal and public action. First of all, Presbyterians, and in our tradition, we have generally thought of God primarily in terms of energy, activity, moral purpose, intentionality, in contrast to other traditions which have thought of God in considerable measure as truth, or beauty, or unity, and so forth. God sits above the heavens, stretches out the heavens like a curtain, holds the water in his hands, counts the nations of the earth as a small dust of the balance, and the kings of earth as naught. Now, secondly, this vision of God as energy and intentionality leads to a vision of God as active in history and of human life, or the Christian life, as the embodiment of the purposes of God. God's election is not simply an election to the ultimate destinies of heaven and hell, but the election to be the instruments of the divine purposes here and now in human history. Calvin believed that God called people not simply to be Christian, but call people to be instruments in Geneva, becoming a Christian community. And wherever the Reformed have gone, they carried with them this vision of the Christian community. They sought to establish the New Jerusalem, England's green and pleasant land, at least the Puritans did. They went on an errand into the wilderness to demonstrate in Massachusetts the possibility of a Christian community to the decaying society in Europe. As Michael Walzer, Harvard sociologist and historian, has said, those whom the Calvinists called saints, later generations would call politicians. The Reformed have never thought of the Christian life simply in terms of personal piety. Thirdly, Christians in general, and Reformed in particular, have a high doctrine of the preciousness of human life. Human life is precious not so much because of its own intrinsic merit, though surely there is nothing more wonderful than a human life in all creation. But the preciousness of human life inheres in the fact that God thought of me before I was, that God knows me my name, that he called me into being and gave me my individuality, my identity, my name. Calvinists have always known the people of sinners. In an older day, when Christians were tougher, they sang about their being worms. A more effete Presbyterian community changed words to sinners as though that were a less pejorative term. But the Calvinists have always said, among us worms, don't start pushing me around. Now, I heard this illustrated very well once in 1948. I went to a public meeting over in Yale Law School when the secretary of the Communist Party was explaining why the communists were supporting Henry Wallace, though Henry Wallace was not a card-carrying communist. And he spoke of this, of how when the communists came to power in America, they would guarantee civil rights. Finally, a Negro student stood up and said this worried him as a person who had been denied civil rights, and he pushed the communists to say, do you really mean you're going to guarantee to me as a human being civil rights? Which the communists honestly answered, we guarantee civil rights to the friends of the working man. To which this young student replied, that is simply the problem. My only hope, he said, is in Christian faith. As Nicholas Bajaev put it, where there is no God, there is no man. By that he meant that if you leave God out of the picture, a person has value only insofar as he or she belongs to the right political party, the right race, the right class, the right nation, and so forth. If there is no God, is there anything grievously wrong with Russians liquidating millions of peasants, or even with the Jewish Holocaust? The preciousness of human life inheres in the fact that God thought of me before I was. A human being is, in the fourth place, responsible. The power of the human spirit, the capacity to transcend life, to act for oneself, to think for oneself. This means that Calvinists have never thought of human life as simply passive. In terms of what happens to us, in terms of the fate that is, that's not a good Calvinist word, but in terms of what is handed out to us in history, they have always put the emphasis upon our own initiative in doing something with the resources that are available to us and in responding to the events that happen to us. Calvinists have also thought of life as a vocation, a calling. Calvin once said that this sense of being called by God makes the most menial task very precious in the sight of God. They also understood that life's highest end is the glorification of God, not the fulfillment of human desires, not even the salvation of the human soul. As Eustace Percy put it in his very perceptive Life of John Knox, the best servants of the state are those who have not the state as its highest good, but God. The Calvinist emphasis upon simplicity, for Calvin, the ornate, the ostentatious, the pretentious, the pompous, always covers up reality. Life must be simple. Simplicity uncovers reality. Simplicity is sincerity. Now, let me fit quickly to certain negative theological convictions. One is that the transcendence of God must be emphasized in all of our political action. That is to say, the church must guard against identifying ambiguous political activities with the will of the transcendent God. I wish I could speak further on that. Therefore, the church must encourage criticism. I associated myself once with a program on hunger with the Institute on Religion and Democracy, which is outside the control of the church. And there were those from the bureaucratic wing of the church who called up the president of Union Seminary and asked him what he was going to do about my speaking at that conference, which I think is very interesting. You have censorship on the left as well as on the right. And he responded he wasn't going to do anything. But did he ask him? He said, I would like for you to tell me how I could do something about it. I assume he might thought he might want to do something about something else later. The attempt to stifle criticism. As Paul Tillich said, Protestantism can be safe only if it is subject to criticism outside of itself by groups, by people who are not under the control of the process. It's interesting to me that in the church, people who glory in the New York Times and the Washington Post do not want independent newspapers or independent institutions criticizing the life of the church. Then better move on. The awareness of the ambiguity of all moral and theological policies, institutions, social configurations. There is no such thing, at least in Calvinism, as Christian politics, as Christian economics, as the Christian social ordering of society. There is such a thing as Christians who are involved in social, economic, and political activity. But all economic, political, and social activity is morally and theologically ambiguous. Thirdly, it seems to me Reformed theology insists on an awareness of what is possible in history. What is possible in history is limited by time and space, by energy, by historical background, by geography. It's also limited by human freedom. And so far as we can know, God will always continue to respect human freedom. Therefore, what is possible in history is limited. I would like to say more about that, but I'm afraid I'll be called to stop here. They say, finally, that an awareness that human life can be fulfilled and completed by no human enterprise. Augustine long ago knew that everything human is transient. Our only security is in God. This was put very graphically for me and for some others in 1947 when Emil Brunner, in a lecture at Yale University, concluded by saying that the United States is perhaps the most wonderful achievement of the human spirit in the history of the human race on this planet. But he said, there will come a day when the United States will no longer exist. When that day comes, each one of us will still exist. Therefore, in a very fundamental sense, what happens in a human soul is more important than what happens in the history of a great society.
Questions to Dr. Lee.
I have an observation and a question, both of which come from my own professional bent, which is being a research scientist. And the first thing is that the comment is that when you mention people like Paul Lowe or Billy Graham or anybody else who said the president's name, for example, we also have people in our community, the scientific community, who do that. And it's not necessarily that they are the ones who...
I don't understand. If you speak a little louder, clearer.
I'm sorry.
Lower.
You were mentioning people like Billy Graham or Jerry Falwell who sit at the president's table and are often, you know, given favor by the government because of things they say or do. You suggested that maybe that's because they're bringing a lot of votes. One of the other reasons that kind of thing happens is because they represent a community and say the things that they want heard from the community. They say the right things that government at that point in time wants heard by the community. That's the comment. The other thing I wanted to get to is a much more philosophical point, and I think it kind of underlies this issue on a lot of levels. And it's the question of whether, as Christians, we can really go along with a kind of reductionist view of mankind, of the church, of society, or anything else, as opposed to a holistic view. And every time we seem to be asking the question of whether we should or should not participate in certain things, it implies that we can split things up and reduce them to parts that don't interact anymore. Individualism itself is based on that kind of idea, that I can somehow exist as an individual and not really be part of all the stuff that's going on around me. Could you, from a theological perspective, give us a feeling for how do you feel about that, holistic versus reductionist?
I really don't know what you mean by holistic and communal, but briefly to answer, I think human life is individual, and it's also communal. And I do not want to be either robbed of my individuality or of my communal life. I think each has to have its own integrity.
Other questions? Jack?
Dr. Lee, you mentioned that 99% of the denomination's employees voted one way and 80% of the people in the pew voted the other way. It seems to me for years in our denomination we've had a situation where the denomination goes one way and the people in the pew think another way. Is there a way to promote accountability in the church or more of a correlation between what the people in the pews believe to make the programs of the church possible and the positions that the church takes on a national level?
Well, I think two things. One is, I think we ought to guard against a bureaucratic class in the church. And I heard that phrase recently from a person who has always been identified with the left wing of the church. But I think we ought to guard against the bureaucratic class. I think bureaucracy has inherent dangers, whether it's in business or in government or in the church. And traditionally, in the church, organizational leadership and bureaucratic leadership came out of a long history of life within the local congregation. One was not appointed to a significant job in the bureaucratic life of the church, which in Protestantism is recently 100 years old. Bureaucracy in Protestantism is, as we know it now, developed in the last 100 years. That all of these people were folks who had come out of the authentic life of the local congregation. And Jeffrey Haddon, a Western Reserve sociologist in the mid-60s, said one of the crises was the fact that you had now a bureaucracy that had not been related to the local congregations or intimately related. I've sometimes said that if you cure a lot of problems, if before you could be appointed to any bureaucratic leadership position in the church, you had to have brought a sufficient number of people into the church by your own efforts. You were accountable for their being members of the church, whose net contributions would at least pay your salary and expense account. That would solve a world of the organizational problems in the church.
Other questions, Dick?
Dr. Lee, I'm concerned about proof texting, and we see often references to Matthew 25 and Genesis 1 as being reasons for certain strategies, but I'd like to hear your reasons, some of your theological reasons, for some of the strategies that you have followed. I know you've been active in the Democratic Party. I know that you have been active in the IRD. How does your theology help shape your direction?
Well, I have been somewhat active in the IRD, and I've been active in the IRD for two reasons. One is, I think freedom is important. I think one of the test words is where the people speak simply about compassion without speaking about freedom. I think that marks you where you stand. And I think in the Presbyterian tradition, historically, no one would have ever spoken about justice without speaking about freedom. I think a good question is, which is more important, freedom or justice? And, you know, if you push me, I'd say freedom, because in the long run, if you don't have freedom, you're not going to have justice. I would say the emphasis over against you do not hear much on the part of the church, mainline church's pronouncements in recent years about freedom. You hear a great deal about justice. That is one reason. The second reason is, I think it's the same reason I am for 25 years on the board of the Presbyterian Outlook. I think it's critically important that you have free institutions and agencies to criticize the official life of the church. When Aubrey Brown was editor of the Presbyterian Outlook, he was never liked by any of the church bureaucrats. And they didn't like him because he uncovered what was going on. Today, there are virtually no independent church papers. Practically all church papers are house organs. And even Independent Christian Century is really a house organ for the National Council of Churches. We need free institutions to subject the church to criticism and review. How long, I mean, do you think anything would have ever happened about Richard Nixon if there had not been free institutions to bring critical review to his work? If Nixon had controlled the processes that reviewed him, nothing would have ever happened. And the same thing's true in the life of the church. And we have just about eliminated any independent critical activity in the life of the church.
One more question. One more.
I have
you.
John, if you were a pastor today, what priorities would you want your session to be dealing with in a local congregation?
Well, Hugh, you're going to say the same thing that everybody else says to me, that I'm no longer a pastor, and I say this. I'd say the first responsibility of the, one of the first responsibilities of the session is to guarantee that you hear good preaching, that you hear preaching as equally technically as good as the people you expect to do your work in law and medicine. And secondly, I would say the session is supposed to guarantee teaching in the church. And thirdly, pastoral care, by which I don't mean counseling, but visiting in homes. And when the session has done this, then, you know, I think it might reflect about the wider matters of society. And this is a very serious issue. We are witnessing today the decline of the mainline churches in American life. In 1947, 69 out of every 100 Americans gave Protestant preference. In 82, according to Gallup, that was down to 59%. 20 years ago, 6 out of every Americans gave a Presbyterian preference. That's down to about 6 to 7. That's down to 4. There are more Presbyterians in positions of leadership in North Carolina than any other state in the Union. But there is not a single county in North Carolina now where Presbyterians are the largest group. You can be dead certain that 20 years from now, Presbyterians will not exercise the kind of political and social leadership simply because of the relative decline of the Presbyterian church. And while we have been declining, probably the most phenomenal thing in American church life in the last 30 years has been the phenomenal growth of churches connected with the Southern Baptist Convention. And it's not without reason that the richest man in Virginia is a Southern Baptist. President, probably the most vigorous company in the church, in Richmond is a Southern Baptist. 25, 30 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. This decline is going to diminish the testimony of Protestantism and Presbyterianism in American society. Now, we can be glad that the more conservative, and I don't like to give them the name evangelical, have moved into ascendancy. We should be glad that the church is here, and the church is thriving in many ways. But if you believe that Presbyterianism and Protestantism are important for American society, as I do, then this is a very ominous fact.
John, let me ask you just on continuing that question, just one
time, Mr. Moderator.
I'm going to push you just a little bit. One of the things that I have noticed over the last 20 years that I've been in the ministry is a kind of hyperactivity on the part of the denomination that every day you get some kind of new thing that the church is supposed to be concerned about. What would you do with all that?
Well, it's sort of like even Union Seminary. When you get a lot of mailing, you know somebody doesn't really have much to do. And that work always fills vacant places. And if you don't really have a good job, then you create a tremendous amount of task forces and papers. And I think that's happened in the church. And instead of getting on with the main business of the church. We don't have a real good youth program in the church, but we have all kinds of task forces talking about every kind of issue. And you, as I said, it's not the extraordinary matters. We've talked about every issue. Not everyone. You have a hard time finding any pronouncement of the church really takes seriously the alcohol problem in our society, or even the drug problem, and you certainly will not find any pronouncement in the last 20 or 30 years saying that you ought to do a day's work for a day's pay, the old Protestant work ethic. We've been somewhat selective, though we have covered pretty much the waterfront and identified the most trivial issues. Our general counsel even spoke on the extension of time to vote in the name of the transcendent God. They declared that the time to vote on ERA should have been extended. That is trivializing social action and the church's public witness.